Get your tents. We'll go ahead and get this meeting kicked off. Appreciate everybody being here tonight. Here from the sportsman group. Let's have the rack introduce ourselves. So we'll start down on this end and tell us who you are and what you represent.
My name's Daniel Davis. I represent Sportsman.
Richie Anderson, Cattleman, Uinta County Public Lands Committee.
Dan Abeda, Forest Service.
Joe Batty, Private Landowners.
I'm Dax Mangus. I'm sitting in for Board
Mission.
I'm Brett Prevedel. I'm representing the public at large.
David Gordon, representing the Bureau of Land Management.
Andrea Merrill, non-consumptive.
Tim Ignacio, Ute Indian Tribe.
All right, thank you. We'll start off. We've got some comment cards. If you'd like to comment on that, please fill out one of these cards. They're on the table just as you came in. I will ask you to fill out one of these, and then when it's time, we'll ask you to step up to the mic here. Kind of tell you the way we operate here is
got a haircut again.
Division will, when it's time, they'll go ahead and make a presentation to the group here, and then we'll ask for some questions, and that's. Well, if you have any questions, please step up and comments. So hold your comments until then, if you would, please. So with that, we'll go ahead and get kicked off here. Has the RAC members been able to take and view the minutes of the last meeting yet?
Mr. Chair, I thought maybe you'd go ahead and read them to us.
I'm sorry. I don't have that time. I can't speed read that fast.
Anyway.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and make a motion that we approve the agenda as it is and also the minutes from the last RAC meeting.
Okay. Brett's got, we've got a motion to approve, but Brett's got one possible.
I can't get my email to up with the minutes, but on the recommendation that the.
You're speaking to the mic over there so that Rory gets it.
On the recommendation that the division look into utilizing to scheduling some hunts during the rut that we voted on, that you asked that they look into. The minutes reflect deer. We were having a discussion about elk hunting.
For the archery. You're talking about the archery?
For the recommendation to the division that they look into scheduling a bow hunt during the rut.
Okay.
The minutes say deer.
Oh, thank you, Rory. Did you catch that? Okay. That was an archery elk. Thank you. Do we have any other discussion? Can I get a second to the approval of the minutes?
I'll second that.
Okay, we got a second. All in favor?
I don't know if I can. I wasn't here.
Okay. We got unanimous with exception of one that wasn't here. How about the agenda? We need to approve our agenda for tonight. Any discussion on the agenda? I'll entertain a motion for that.
I motion that we go ahead and approve the agenda as presented.
And Abeda made that second. All in favor?
Aye.
And it is unanimous. All right. Thank you. A little update on the Wildlife Board. Dan, I haven't asked you to do that. Would you like to give a...
Are you
prepared for that?
Yep. I've got a copy of the summary of the motions that were made and how that turned out. So kind of a long one, so bear with me here. Let's see. Kind of getting down to the action items here. There was a... An old business action log item, kind of a contingent. It was on CWMU single permits, and that was not recommended. Action item number four here is the waterfowl recommendations and rule amendments for 2018. There was a motion made, and that was seconded, and that passed unanimously. The taking of non-game mammals rule amendment. That motion was made, seconded, and looks like that I'm seeing here that that was approved. I don't see whether that what the vote
on
that
was. It was passed unanimously.
Okay, I'm not seeing that. But on the Bucks Bowls and Once in a Lifetime, the season dates, the application timeline. Let's see here. That motion was made, seconded. Let's see. That passed. That did pass unanimously as well. Let's see. There was also a motion made to approve the Bighorn Sheep Hunt on the Oak Creek unit. Let's see here, and that failed 4-2. Let's see, 4-3. Was it 3? Okay.
Hey Dan, just real quick, wanted to jump in. The division did modify the recommendation on the Buck Bowl Once in a Lifetime season date and hunt boundaries after the RAC process.
Oh, okay.
And the boundary was changed for the bison hunt, the Book Cliffs Wild Horse Bench 9 mile bison hunt. As was recommended in this RAC, to remove the Range Creek portion from that hunt boundary, the division modified their recommendation to remove that, like this, which would go along with the way most of the RACs voted, and that was part of the division's recommendation when it passed.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that clarification.
Dan?
Yes.
I give you that. It's kind of color coded the ones, the motions down below, and then passed, but the yellow is just the action.
Okay.
The action item. But just read the motions and the.
Okay, that sounds good. So, here's where I was. I think the motion here to accept the new archery only once in a lifetime bighorn sheep hunts on the Newfoundland and the Zion unit, and let's see on that one there. And that motion actually died. So, accept them. See them. I don't have a hard time seeing that. So there was a motion made to accept the multi-season hunt, and this is for elk, I believe. Diana, is that right here?
Yeah, those are kind of hard. The motions down below and up above is how they how it was.
Yeah. And that one actually, yeah. So the motion there was a motion to accept the multi-season hunt, and that passed 4-2. I know there was a lot of discussion on that. So also a motion on the early rifle season or any weapon season hunt for deer, and that one passed unanimously, excluding the Panguitch Lake unit. Okay. Let's see here. So there was also a motion to accept the division's alternative recommendations provided by the Mule Deer Management Committee, allowing for a late muzzleloader limited entry hunt on units that exceed the buck-to-doe ratio objective, and keep last year's units minus the Plateau Boulder and Kaperowitz. And add the Beaver North. That did go through and pass unanimously as well. Another motion was to accept the bison recommendations as they were presented. Okay. And that passed unanimously. And then, like you mentioned, Dax, the change with the boundary there. There was also a motion to approve the cactus buck hunt on the Ponsagaunt, and that passed unanimously. Let's see here. What's this about? I'm not sure if that one really applies. It's a busy meeting. On the Ponsagaunt unit as well, there was a rifle date to begin alongside the limited entry hunt date at the end of the last day of October. In addition, the division may adjust the other management hunts accordingly. That passed on a 5-1 vote. So another motion is to put on the action log a review of the season date change for archery deer hunting and add a survey concerning this issue prior to the next revision of the statewide deer management plan in 2022. The division will report back next year to look at how the season dates would look with the requested change, and that passed unanimously as well. Let's see. And then a motion to accept the remainder of the Bucks, Bulls, and Once in a Lifetime season dates and application, and that passed. Let's see here. Unanimously there. Also, another motion here, and this was to accept R657-5, taking big game rule amendments as presented by the division, including a definition change for a cactus buck of 50% velvet coverage to antlers, and that action, there's not a vote on that motion, so I'm not sure what happened there. Moving here to the removal of wild mule deer from domesticated elk facilities. That passed unanimously as well. The statewide pronghorn management plan passed unanimously. The statewide moose management plan, that passed unanimously. And let's see here. There were some northern region deer management plans that also passed unanimously as well. The CWMU management plans and permit numbers for 2018, that passed unanimously. There's some discussion on the Jump Creek CWMU. Their three-year COR with the understanding that they will apply for a variance. Let's see that one. 2 years. Oh, okay. So that was one where I think that they didn't have quite the acreage. Is that right, Dax? On the Jump Creek CWMU. And that passed unanimously as well. Kind of on a one-year basis there. Landowner Association permit numbers for 2018. They passed unanimously as well. And then the mentor rule amendments,
Dan, just
they pass unanimously as well.
Real quick on the landowner association permits, a couple of the associations in our region had a different request than the division recommendation. And the Book Cliffs Landowner Association had requested 9 elk permits. The division had recommended 3, and this RAC voted to give them 6, and that's what the board did as well, gave them 6. And the Three Corners Landowner Association had requested 5. The division had recommended 4, and the board awarded Three Corners 5 as well.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Let's see here. Mentioned the mentor rule amendments passing unanimously. And I think that was it. It was kind of like I say, it was a busy night.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're ready for Dax. You got an update for us on the region, Dax?
You know, we met so recently. I talked with Boyd, and I think we're just going to go real quick on a regional update. Just one of the big projects that's been accomplished in the last week we thought it'd be fun to highlight is we put 100 GPS collars out on deer in the Book Cliffs unit as part of the migration initiative study, and including does, fawns, and bucks. And that's been a big project and a lot of fun. And other than that, I don't think we're going to have any more update right now just because we met so recently. There'll be a location every 2 hours, an exact GPS coordinate every 2 hours on those collars. So. We're really excited about what we're going to find out with that. Maybe Tanya has a couple pictures. I know a couple of our board members and sportsman partners came and helped with some of this project, and it's pretty neat to have hands-on live bucks. We don't do that very often. It was kind of a neat opportunity.
I got one of Clint, if you want to see it.
There's a couple of the ones on the box.
We had one really neat one. Our veterinarian from our Salt Lake office, our wildlife vet, was there on the scene, and one of the bucks they brought in had a big infected wound on its neck, and its nose had been crushed, and it had a big cut on its hind quarter. It had been attacked by a lion. Here's a picture of this infected wound on the neck and the crushed nose. And our veterinarian proceeded to clean out the infected cut, and she gave him some stitches in the nose so that he only has two nostrils now instead of three or four, and cleaned out all the wounds. And it'll be interesting to see what happens if this buck survives, but he had definitely been worked over by a lion probably a week or so before we caught him for this project. But we do have a GPS collar on that buck, and I think after the vet doctored him up a little bit, he's got a little bit better chance of making it, but tough bugger. And that's it for an update for now.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll turn the time over to Darren for the 2018 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Let's see. Let me get this up here real quick. Start in the middle. Let's see. It's my fault, I'm sure.
Can you help?
So tonight I'll be presenting our 2018 Black Bear Recommendations, and I thought I would start. I know we've got some new members of the RAC. Can you hear me? Okay. I'll try and do better here. So I thought I'd just do kind of a really brief background on bear management in the state and kind of how things have gone over the last little while. First of all, the role of the division is to serve the people of Utah as a trustee and guardian of the state's wildlife. We actively manage black bear populations. That is that we try to manipulate populations up and down depending on needs on the ground, depending on objectives that we have in our plans. And one part of that active management is hunting. Hunting is a key part. It builds and maintains interest and support for bear conservation. It allows our biologists to meet their management objectives. It also can help us to address human conflict issues. We've been managing black bears in the state for 50 years. So in 1967, up until that point, bears were similar to coyotes. They weren't protected in any way. You could take a bear anytime, anywhere that you came across one. Conservationists, hunters, are the folks in 1967 that went to the legislature and got bears and lions put into a protected status. At first, things didn't change a lot. You know, tags were unlimited. There actually weren't very many black bears in the state back then. We didn't take very many every year, probably less than 10 those first few years. In 1986, though, We felt like we had growing bear populations, but we didn't know a whole lot about bears. And in 86 is when we really started a lot of studies to look at black bears in Utah and look at their biology, look at their life histories, try to start figure out more about bears and how they made a living out there on the landscape. And as a result of those studies, in the late 90s, we convened a discussion group and wrote a black bear plan. That's the first plan that we wrote in Utah. In 2011, that plan was amended, and we made some changes, and that's the current plan we're operating under. So this plan started in 2011, and it'll run through 2023, with three-year cycles to go back and look at the plan, make any necessary changes that we feel like we need to do, or not make changes if we feel like things are going well. So we look at bear data on a three-year basis. So when you see some of the stats tonight, we're looking at 3 years of compiled data. The last cycle was in 2015. We actually made quite a few significant changes that year. We added spot and stock type of opportunities. We moved seasons around, and that was the last time that we looked at those things. So what does our management plan say? The overall goal of the plan is to maintain healthy bear populations within the existing habitat. And in
areas where we have low or no bear numbers, but habitat and low potential for conflict, we let bears grow in some of those areas. But all of this is while taking into account human safety, economic concerns, and other wildlife species. And just the plan defines a healthy bear population as one that has a significant or a sufficient breeding age. Sorry, I'm on cough medicine, so I apologize. A healthy bear population is one with a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat and also maintain genetic variability. So that's what we're aiming for. So how do we accomplish that? I'm not going to dive too far into this. I'll be happy to answer any questions that anybody has, but I think it just in the interest of time. We manage bear units under three general strategies: light harvest, moderate harvest, or liberal harvest. Up on that chart, you can see how many units fall into each of the categories. The plan is written so that liberal and light are intentionally smaller. There are fewer units in those categories than in the moderate. A light harvest unit might be one where your bear numbers are low, conflict potential is low, and you might want to see populations grow a little bit. So that management strategy would grow bears. Moderate harvest is built to maintain bear numbers, but depending on what's going on the unit, you could either let that increase slowly or decrease slowly. And liberal harvest are for units that are primarily managed to lower bear populations, units where conflict is high, or for some reason we feel like we don't want large numbers or high densities of bears on those units. Depending on which harvest strategy we use, we look at adult males in the harvest and females to determine what we do with permits. All of the permit recommendations you'll see tonight fall within the management plan parameters, except for one unit, and I'll point that out when we get there. Last year, we had six topics that the board asked us to look into this year. These aren't action items, but they were items that the board wanted us to get together and discuss. The first was there's concern, you know, bears are difficult. It's difficult to estimate population numbers on bears because they're hard to see. They disappear in the winter. We're looking at ways that we can be more effective at least estimating densities or tracking trends. One way I'll highlight tonight, we have gone in and used our harvest data to calculate a trend and actually come up with a minimum adult population estimate. Some other things that we'd like to look into is we're working with BYU. They're trying to isolate. They're working with their chemistry department to isolate scents and see if they can find something that is a real good bear attractant. If we could find something that's reliable, we might be able to institute on some of these denser bear units our DNA mark recapture kind of population study. So you put a barbed wire, you draw the bears in with a scent, and they pull hair on the wire, and you can identify individual bears by their DNA and get an estimate of population that way. Another thing that we're going to put on deer available of the same collars, the same kind of collars, for more bears, and so on units with high bear densities like the Book Cliffs, the LaSalles, the San Juan, trying to get more female bears on the air and pick up those birth pulses. So those bears have cubs. We'll visit the dens, but we'll also get a lot of day-to-day information on how those bears are used in the landscape. So we've got collars coming, and we'll continue that effort. The next topic I think we'll talk more about tonight, so I won't spend a lot of time on it now, but the board did ask us, the proposal that came out of the RAC process last year was to take the San Juan LaSalle hunt seasons and put that onto the Book Cliffs. Book Cliffs has a different season strategy. We did put a group together. I'll show you who was on the group here in just a second, but had a lot of good discussions. We did talk hunt strategies quite a bit. And you'll see some of that tonight from the groups. One thing that happened after we finished that discussion, we kind of brought things back internally. We identified some concerns with some of the things we talked about, but also we identified a lot of other issues that we felt like needed to be addressed, and it includes things like livestock impacts. How do you get, we're starting on some of these unit staff to put a lot of bear hunters in the field. How do you do that? And so our recommendation this year will reflect our desire to look at all of these things and make all these changes at once. So we're not making any big season change recommendations tonight. The other thing was on these restricted hunts, restricted pursuit seasons, like on the Book Cliffs, the LaSalles, it was requested that we put a preference point system into place. You'll see a recommendation along those lines tonight as well. The other issue, pack size restriction for dogs. We talked to our law enforcement guys, and it's really tough to enforce that. If you say you can only have so many, you've got to figure out who belongs to which pack, and it's just really tough. And so we felt like with these restricted hunt opportunities, if we do have problems with a lot of people afield with a lot of dogs, we could simply implement a restricted season and try to address it that way. So we won't be making any recommendations tonight as far as pack sizes go. I don't know how many of you remember or aware, but on the LaSalle and San Juan, the region down there had some concerns about pursuit and pursuit pressure and how that might be affecting how bears are used in the landscape during those seasons. They were getting bears showing up in Moab, middle of the summer, places where bears shouldn't be, and they wondered if maybe some of that pursuit was one of the factors that were causing bears to leave the mountain. And so what they've done the last 3 years, they have a light pursuit number of permits on the LaSalles. So they had 5 permits on the LaSalles, 15 on the San Juan. What they want to do is flip that beginning this year and run it for 3 more years and just see if they can detect the difference, you know, and see if maybe that's a thing that's happening or maybe it's not a thing that's happening. So the recommendations rule for you reflect that. And finally, we had some concern about harvest objective units on public land units. So what the plan says is that we'll avoid using those on units that are dominated by public land. And there actually are some units that harvest objective makes sense. It's a way to get more opportunity out there. The way harvest objective works is we have a number of bears that we want taken, say 10. You can sell as many permits as you want, so a lot of people can go hunting. But once the 10 bears are taken, then the unit would shut down. And so the biggest concern here was on the Wasatch, and we will make a recommendation tonight along those lines as well. This is a list of the people who are invited to come together, the groups that were invited to come together and discuss these topics. And several of those folks are here tonight, so if you've got questions for them, I'm sure that they'll be available. So let's get into data. Since 2014, these are our statewide success and harvest numbers. The 2017 numbers we begin this process actually quite early, at the end of October, to get everything together. And so, you know, those numbers are up until the end of October. We do have later seasons in November, so they don't reflect anything that would have happened after that time, but generally those seasons don't produce a lot of success. But 48% last year, 365 bears. Success has held fairly steady over the last 4 years, about 50% for bear hunting overall. This graph just kind of graphically shows similar data. The yellow line are the number of permits we've issued since 1990. You see how that trend has gone. The red line are the number of bears that are taken by sportsmen. This doesn't include bears taken by wildlife services or by our personnel that are you know, into cabins or eating sheep or things like that. Those would be in addition to this. So this just shows what sportsmen have taken over that time period. Here's the population estimate that I talked about earlier. This is a minimum adult population. So this is bears 2 years and older, and it's based on our harvest data. So when you take a bear, you have to bring the bear into one of our offices and have it checked in. So if we get a bear in our office that's 4 years old, in this year. We know that last year it was 3 years old, and so forth. And you can back calculate how many bears, the minimum number you would have had to have to sustain the harvest that you see going through time. So that's what this is based on. The most important thing here isn't necessarily the number, but the trend. And you can see that we've had a growing bear population since 2000, but especially since about 2005, we've had steady growth. It looks like it might be leveling off over the last 3 years, but we had a similar pattern in 08, 09, and 10. So we'll keep an eye on it. The management plan is designed to take that into effect. So if we see populations decline, then the management plan would pick that up, and you'd see permit recommendations reflect that. Predation is also an issue with bears, especially this last year. We had a pretty big uptick in bear depredations, mostly on sheep. But over time, that yellow line shows the number of bears taken by Wildlife Services or by the division. That remains fairly constant. The red line shows the number of sport harvest of bears. So as we've been growing the population, by and large, sportsmen have been benefiting by that increase in population. You can see that they've had more opportunity to take bears as the population grows. Our problem bears tend to stay fairly level, but it does kind of bounce around through time. And it depends a lot on, in some cases, on the weather, whether they've got mast in the fall, that kind of thing. So let me get into our season recommendations. We're recommending a spring limited entry season from March 31st to June 1st. This would be a dogs only season with no bait allowed. That's the same as last year, just adjusting for the calendar. This summer limited entry season, we're recommending a change. Currently that hunt, or up until now, that hunt began on June 2nd. So it began the day after the spring limited entry season started. What we're recommending is moving that opening date a week earlier. But what we've had up until this point, too, is a two-week early baiting season before that bait season started. We're recommending that go away. So if you hunt bait or spot and stock during that season, you'll get an extra week, but you won't be able to put your bait out until the hunt starts. And this is something that we talked about in the committee. We kind of went around and around with it. This is a little bit of a compromise on some of the original ideas, and we felt comfortable with this, and the archery folks did as well, so we're making that recommendation. Fall limit entry season, this is just general seasons. These are the same as they have been, just adjusting for the calendar. And you would be allowed to bait 2 weeks early on those fall seasons. There are also multi-season limited entry opportunities. If you draw that permit, you can hunt all of those seasons that we just looked at. So the season dates will change depending on which unit you draw. And then there are some harvest objective units as well. That season is, for the spring, is the same as the others. But there's also a fall opportunity on the 9 mile, which is a spot and stock only from September 24th, or 25th, sorry, to October 26th. There are a few units with alternate seasons. So on the book list, Bitter Creek South, we're recommending an archery-only hunt from August 6th through the 7th of September, and a combined dogs and bait season from October 1st through November 15th. That's not a change. That's what it was last year. Spring and fall limited entry on the roadless area, the same archery season, but spot and stock only from March 31st through June 1st, and then again from September 8th through November 15th. Early bait on both of those. On the LaSalle and San Juan, we're recommending dogs and bait August 11th through the 14th of September. No dogs from the 15th of September to the 24th, that's when the any weapon limited entry bull season is. So you could still hunt that with that permit, but you couldn't use dogs during the bull hunt. And then again, November 3rd through the 15th, and a spot and stock season from October 2nd through the 23rd. Again, these aren't changes. These are the same as they have been. So moving on to individual units and permit recommendations. In this region, we're recommending an increase of 3 permits on the Book Cliffs, Little Creek roadless area. All the other permits would remain the same as last year. In the northern region, we're recommending an additional 2 permits on the Chalk Creek Camas North Slope Summit Unit. In the central region, on the Nebo, 3 more permits. On the Wasatch Mountains West Central, we're recommending that change from a harvest objective unit to a limited entry unit, and that the permits be increased by 10. Southeastern region is where most of our bears live, and so we're recommending increases along with the plan, in accordance with the plan. But you can see those numbers there. So for the North Manti, 7. For the South Manti, 7. For the LaSalle's, 25. For the 9 Mile, 9. And for the San Juan, 25. The southern region, 2 additional permits on the Beaver, 2 on the Panguitch Lake Zion, 2 on the Ponsigant, 2 on the Boulder. And then the last one, Fish Lake, that's where they had their fires. The plan would have recommended 3 permit increase. But because of that habitat loss, they wanted to be conservative, and they're only recommending 1 additional permit down there. Our pursuit seasons, same as last year, spring season, summer season, and fall. These are the general pursuit seasons. We also have restricted pursuit seasons on the Book Cliffs, the LaSalle's, and the San Juan. Those dates will be July 5th through July 18th, and July 25th through August 5th. That's what we're recommending. So we talked about preference points before. When we got looking into that and looking at the interest in those permits, the way a preference point works is if you don't draw in year one, you get a preference point. In year two, everybody that gets a preference point gets drawn first. And if there's any left over, then if you don't have a point, you'd be drawn. Because of the interest in those hunts, it probably would have taken about 20 years to ever draw again once you drew with a preference point. But with a bonus point, half of the permits go to just a straight draw, so the odds are what they are, and the other half go to people with bonus points. And so the more bonus points you have, the more opportunity you have to draw one of those permits. We felt like that'd be a better way to go. So we're recommending a bonus point system for restricted pursuit seasons, and that would include a 2-year waiting period. And we're just proposing we amend the rule, R657-62, to reflect that. Also, after the last big game meetings, there were some changes made to archery equipment requirements. So we're proposing we change the bear rule to reflect those. So just the changes that they did for big games. So instead of a 40-pound draw weight, you'd only need a 30-pound. There's no restriction on weight of the arrow. There's some crossbow restrictions that they changed. And then other than that, in the bear rule, just some cleanup of language. Prima facie evidence has been replaced with probable cause. That just reflects burden of proof and presumption of innocence kind of thing. So we're doing that across all of our rules where prima facie evidence is called out. We were changing that. And then just a call back to the bonus point rule under the bonus point section. So, in summary, change the summer bait season from May 26th to June 29th with no early baiting. In accordance with the management plan guidelines, 860 total bear permits. That's an increase of 102 permits from last year. Bonus points for restricted pursuit seasons with a 2-year waiting period, and the archery and crossbow changes reflected in the big game rule. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Darren. Questions by the RAC members?
I got one, Mr. Chairman.
Daniel?
This will probably be for Clint, but you might have an answer to the trial hunting program or the experiment. I don't know how we reference that, but with the late season bait hunt. In the last 3 years, what's been our combined harvest between that archery only and the fall season? About 6, 7?
I know last year we didn't harvest any bears on that fall. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, would you get up here and state your name, please?
Okay.
Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist. I don't have all the numbers with me, but I know last year, the fall hound hunt, we didn't harvest any bears on that hunt. The 2 years before.
You're talking the fall seasons, the other fall? Permits your harvest, other fall over here with one bear each time.
Yeah, so it looks like one bear a year for those first 2 years.
Awesome. Nice and easy. I know your back's sore. Sorry for making you get up and talk.
No, it's okay.
Brad, you got a question?
No.
Okay. Other question by the rack.
Yeah, I've got a question. So, Darren, it was a slide at the beginning of our presentation about the number of permits sold over the past 25 years or whatever. And it was a big...
Is this the one?
Yeah, I think it was that one there. Yeah, permits issued. It seems like, you know, for a decade and a half, there were it's a pretty flat line there, really. And then all of a sudden, you know, from about 2006 or 2007, we really started to see more permits sold each year. Can you talk to that?
So, going back to the history, so the first bear plan took effect in 99, 2000. And we had different management parameters, and so you can see that, like you said, it was increasing, but not that fast. With the new process in 11, that's where you really see a big jump. And what we did is we added a lot of different opportunity, lower success opportunities, and so permits reflect that. Especially in 15, you can see the last time we made big changes, we added a lot of those spot and stock kind of boot hunt things. And the management strategy changed a little bit, and we've been growing bears. And so, you know, what we've been seeing is that we're consistently exceeding our management objectives in a good way. You know, we've got more bear, well, it is a relative term, but we've got more adult males showing up in the harvest than the parameters. That would indicate an increase in permits, and low female harvest. And so we adjust permits according to those strategies. And then when you lump it all together statewide, that's kind of what it looks like.
Daniel?
So does a bear management plan call out a population objective?
No, it doesn't. Just those, adults 5 years and older and females. There's also a parameter for these birth pulses. And if we can detect those, if we've got enough callers and we can detect those, that would enter into it. Most of the units in the state, we don't have enough callers out. So, again, that's an effort I'd like to really get after over the next little while.
We got Brad behind you.
Daniel's got one more question. He had his hand up. Ask it, then we'll go to Joe and Brad.
So the bear population in Utah has been increasing 5 to 6% every year, right? So when we went to this new strategy in 2015, from 2014 to the 2018 proposal, we've increased permits or recommended increase of now 60% over that time period. In your population diagram about where the population is now with this liberal harvest, are we going to tend to see maybe a 5 to 6% increase in permits once we see that level out?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a lot of moving parts. So it really is managed at a unit basis, and so it's just kind of how everything adds up based on the units. But on units that have dense bear numbers, we're having a hard time keeping up with the increase. So some of these big units like the LaSalle's of San Juan, and we're starting to run into a problem of where do we put all these hunters? How do we get them all in the field during the year when nothing else is going on? And so those are some big questions that I think we're really going to need to tackle in the near future, and maybe even for next year's recommendation cycle. That'd be my objective. So to answer your question, yeah, I'd expect to still see those increases. Again, it's based on a three-year average, so there's going to be a little lag, and we did that on purpose because we don't want to have to react every year to changing numbers. But over time, we should see permits adjust according to how the population is growing or declining.
I can share, and then I'll ask the last one later.
Joe, you got a question?
This is just for personal information. You said you were managing for genetic variability. Can you explain that a little bit?
So that's ideally what you would want. You want to have you don't want to have genetic bottlenecks taking place, and by that I mean you can get so little diversity in genetics you can start seeing mutations that you don't want to see, and it can actually lower the survival of a bear population. So usually the way you address that is by having interconnected populations. You have kind of these meta populations. Bears move around, breed among different populations, and you can maintain a higher genetic variability that way. There's some work I think that could be done there. I don't know. We've done a lot of genetic analysis on bears in the state, and so you know it's probably still a question that that we could look at going forward.
Thank you.
Brad?
I'm good.
You good? Daniel, back to you.
Last one.
Oh, no.
So this last year, it's public, it's out there, it's been in the media. We've seen quite an increase on orphan cubs this year. Is that something to worry about in the future?
I don't think so. It's kind of a random thing. So we had seven bears that we rehabbed this year. Only one was a cub that where the sow was taken by a hunter during that spot and stock season. He just didn't see the cub until after he'd harvested it. The sow was hit on Highway 6, and so we picked the cubs up and brought them back. It really varies. So we had seven this year. We had none last year. I think we had three the year before. It really bounces all over the place. We do currently have a facility in Utah where we can do that, and they do a really good job. So, you know, they come in weighing about 30 pounds. They go out weighing about 130 pounds. They are butterballs. So, you know, we'll see. We did collar them. We'll keep track of them and see. And if it looks like they're going to get into trouble, we can react.
Yeah. Thank you, Darren. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions by the rack? We'll entertain questions by the public. And keep in mind, these aren't comments. We'll have a comment period. But is there any questions in the audience here tonight? Well, I'm not seeing any. Comments. Anybody here in the rack want to have any comments before we go to the public? Okay, we've got, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 comment cards. So we'll take them just in the order that I've got them here.
Randy.
Yes.
Point of personal privilege, he's got a comment.
Oh.
Mr. Chairman, don't we make our comments after the public?
We can, yes.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
J.C. Brewer, you want to come up to the mic, state your name, J.C., and...
J.C. Brewer. I don't hunt bear with a rifle or with dogs. I hunt bear with cameras. For about 6 years now, I've been hunting bear, and, in fact, all wildlife in the book cliffs with cameras. So I don't have a 1, 2, 3 count on things like some of you folks do. I see trends, and I have been advocating for some time pretty strict control of the predators, coyotes, cougars, and bears, in order to allow our deer herd to rebound, get at least up to the objective. It hasn't been to the objective for years. I applaud the division for its habitat work and for holding a line on the recommendations of being virtually the same number as years past. I think that might be helping because I see a trend, an upward trend in our deer herd. But I would like to recommend that the division continue to control predators, especially bears and cougars, until we see that deer herd up to objective. One other recommendation I'd like to make, because I'm seeing a trend also on cameras, is problem bears, captured and relocated bears. They wear ear tags. plastic earrings, I call them. I'm seeing more and more, getting more and more pictures of bears with multiple colors of ear tags. Some, I think, coming from Colorado, but I know that some of them are coming from Utah. I'd like to recommend that at least in the Booklifts, where we have an issue with fawn survival rate, particularly on the summer range, that we see if we can't find some other place to release our problem bears for a few years. Let's see if we can reverse that trend. Thank you.
Thank you, JC. Cody Wilkins.
All right, I'm Cody Wilkins. I'm the president of the Uinta County Cattlemen's Association and also a chair board member of the Uinta County Farm Bureau. And we're just wanted to come and say we're in favor of the increase in the bear permits and in the split hunting and stuff.
Thank you, Cody. Let's see, I got an Aaron Johnson.
Hi there. My name is Aaron Johnson. I'm the vice president of the Utah Houndsman Association. I think a letter was emailed to their acts from our president, Dan Cocaine. I hope most of you got that. I thought I had four or five copies. I got two. So the two toughest guys can have one. If you've had a chance to read our letter, first of all, I'd like to thank Darren for the time he's put into this, and we're sure appreciative of all the hours that he's traveled across the state and the time he's put into it. The Hound Association supports the DWR's proposal, as Darren has presented it, with the following exception. And that exception is the LaSalle, San Juan, and Bookcliffs fall season dates for 2018 be changed to the following: August 6th, November 16th, with hound hunting restriction dates of August 18th through 24th and September 8th through 25th. I can leave you a letter if it'll be good for your notes. The reason that we're asking for this, and there's individuals here that were on that bear committee meeting, and they could probably do a better job than I could to explain it, is there were some complaints, and Darren hinted at that in some of his presentation, amongst sportsmen. These season dates allow for example, the bow hunters to have 3 or 4 days to hunt by themselves, and then the hounds come, and then 3 or 4 days for the bow hunters to hunt at the end by themselves. In the perfect world, we'd all share the mountains and no one would complain, and that's what I think we ought to do. I think people ought to pull up their big boy plants and stop being snowflakes and complaining. But in the real world, people want to fish by themselves and they want to hunt by themselves and they don't want to see anyone else, and so they complain. The unfortunate thing is I was on the LaSalles this last fall where a lot of them complaints were generated. And I can assure you 100% while I was down there hunting, I had more positive sportsman and sportsman interaction than by far negative. On one occasion, we took a 14-year-old girl who was bow hunting with her parents into a bear tree. The bear come running towards us, not knowing where we're at. Boy, we was hollering and hooting and screaming, wild and woolly. I promise you that girl will never have maybe a more memorable bow hunting experience. And it's because the houndman took her into a tree and let her see a bear. That's what sportsmen should be doing, and that's what we have promoted within the Hound Association. Unfortunately, I don't think that lady wrote a letter. And so we hear about all the negative, but let me assure you that there's a lot of positive going on too. And unfortunately, sometimes the squeaky wheel gets most of the attention. So we feel that these season dates would prevent some of those complaints, and it benefits all sportsmen, not just the houndsmen. The Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, they support this letter as well. We've been in contact with them, and they'd like to see these season dates changed as well. I think that's about it. I'll be here for questions if you have any. I'm thankful for the division. I'm thankful for this public process that you guys can come and listen to us, and ask that you consider these recommendations and ask questions about them, and hopefully we can get this changed. Thanks.
Thank you, Aaron. Let's see, I've got one more comment card. If anybody wants to make a comment after this one, please get a card to us. The last card I've got right now is Tucker Matheson.
There was no comment.
Okay. All right. Well, appreciate those comments. Darren will ask you, recommendation that the season date changes. How does the division feel about that?
So this was a season structure that we talked about when we got the group together. I think at the end of the meeting, it'd be fair to say that the groups, at least, that were there felt comfortable with that. Primarily, we're talking about the book cliffs when we talked about this. But a couple things happened. One is we brought that back in. We kind of looked at it. The region is really concerned about houndsmen in the field during those archery seasons. And that still remains the case, and that was the reason that it was moved initially. And so so that's a concern that I think that the RAC should consider tonight. The other thing is on the La Salle's and the San Juan, Guy Wallace looked at this and said, especially on the front end, there's some stuff here that we kind of like the idea of, with, you know, not allowing hounds during the first week of the archery season when the deer hunters are out, and shutting it off at the end when you're getting close to the rut for archery elk hunters, so they can have the mountain to themselves close to the rut. But the difference is that, and Clint, correct me if I'm wrong, but I won't make you get up if I don't have to. You kind of have a separation in time and space later in the year between big game and the bears. And that's not the case on the La Salle's and San Juan. So they have concerns about that October time frame. Right now they don't hunt with hounds. They have a spot and stock season down there. And they're really worried about putting that hound season on top of general season deer, general season, other general season hunts. And so we'd prefer not to do that. I think the other part of this is when we came back and discussed it, we identified some other things that we thought needed attention, and we decided what we'd like to do is remain the same for one more year, put it together at some kind of summit where we talk about, you know, bear issues. This group didn't have a livestock person on it. It was more about those specific things. We'd like to get livestock producers, Farm Bureau involved. And kind of have a big discussion, then make all the changes in one year and move forward. So that's where we're coming from on it.
Okay. Thank you, Darren. Okay. Comments by the RAC? Go ahead. Daniel.
I'll try not to take up all the time. So I too want to say thanks to Darren and Clinton Dax. I was able to participate on this small committee that was put together to discuss this. Thank you, members of the RAC, too. I sent out a letter last year when I couldn't make this RAC meeting, and you guys addressed some of those concerns, and I appreciate that. Those questions I asked earlier about that fall season is because the plan allows for trial programs to take place so we can try these alternative hunt methods and strategies to harvest these bears and minimize conflict. With the proposal UHA has, was a very fair consideration amongst all sportsmen. I'm still that guy out there saying, calling ourselves greedy, that we've got to have the mountain to ourselves and we can't share. Book Cliffs is huge. It's one of the bigger units in the state. The conflict shouldn't be that way. I too myself have been on the mountain, summer pursuit, having the other sportsmen come and ask, hey, I'm looking for a deer I drew out, took me 10 years. We share that information. They use this as a tool because they know how much time we spend in the field, and I hunt everything. There ain't an animal I don't try to hunt. With that said, we're not killing the bears in the fall. Those season dates that we've been trying there for 3 years, we're not getting our bear harvest in the fall like we do, typically hunting them with hounds earlier in the fall season, increase that harvest. You know, some of these hunters, they're not all houndsmen. A lot of folks put in for bear permits. Them fall season tags take 12 to 15 years to draw. And, you know, a lot of these complaints come from general season archery hunters that get a tag every other year, if not every year. that's where that greed comes in and consideration. And I'd like to recommend considering UHA's proposal on that information, because it's a nice balance for the sportsman. It's going to increase our harvest. It's going to increase the success for those hunters that's waited a long time. They're hunting right now with that spike elk season. And if anybody's been in the Book Cliffs during the spike elk hunt, you'll kind of know what that's like. It's hard. Those bears have held up. They're not moving. To say that a houndsman doesn't get out on his own 2 feet and cover some country is a short statement to make, because that's not true. So that it's a great consideration, and I recommend the RAC to consider that.
Thank you, Daniel. Other comments by the RAC?
Clinton and Randall, is it constant, the conflict, or is it just occasional between bow hunters and houndsmen?
I don't know if I dare move this. Clint Sampson, wildlife biologist. So the whole reason that we changed these dates is because of me, probably. When I first started 10 years ago, I was a game warden, and every year it was pretty consistent across the field when those limited entry hunts would start, as far as complaints from limited entry hunters. I didn't get many complaints from the general season hunters, but I guess I took that into consideration after listening to it for about 6 years, and put this proposal together to change the season dates to avoid the conflicts that exist. And it's not that we don't like hounds. I mean, Dax has hunted with hounds before and harvested a bear. I've hunted with hounds and pursuit type stuff. I mean, it's not that we don't have a love and empathy and consideration for the sport, but just those constant conflicts that were occurring with the limited entry hunters and the houndsmen. I mean, they were just appalled that we'd have a hound hunt on top of their limited entry hunt while they were out there trying to, you know, pursue game, and you know, it's challenging enough, and then you add, you know, hounds on top of it. And so what we did was looked at that, changed the season dates, moved the houndsmen into that October, a little bit later in the fall, so they could still overlap with the muzzleloader hunters that we weren't having too many serious conflicts with, and also with the limited entry deer hunters. And we looked at it as we were solving a problem. We also created a new hunt. Like Darren mentioned, we're always constantly looking for ways to get more people in the field that don't allow for more conflicts. And so we created a brand new hunt that had never been out there before in the Book Cliffs, with that archery bait hunt in the fall. We created a great opportunity there. And then we also felt that, I mean, there is conflicts with the spike hunters, but if you think the limited entry guys that have waited several years, many years, are going to be any less abrasive than the spike hunters, I think that might be a misconception as well. But again, we thought we solved the problem, but if we got it wrong, we got it wrong, you know. So like I say, we'll just keep trying. Like we said at the first of the meeting, we are stewards. We are resources to be used, and so if we got it wrong, we got it wrong, and like I say, I'm the one. So thank you.
Mr. Sampson?
Yes, sir.
On that pursuit permits, is the non-residents limited to those pursuit permits, or are they, you're talking about going to a bonus point system there? What are you doing with the non-residents on that?
God, that might be a better question for somebody above my pay grade.
That actually is an issue.
Appreciate the challenge, though, Brad.
Yeah, right.
I wish I got paid.
I might not be through with you, so you might stand there.
So for limited pursuit, it'd be just like any other limited entry permit. There'd be a certain number of non-resident tags that'd be available, depending on the total number of tags. So you'd have to get to 10, at least, to have one non-resident tag. But one thing that, you know, we weren't specifically asked to consider this, but discussions started in the group about non-residents, and
surrounded by states that have eliminated hound hunting and bait hunting, and there's a lot of interest in coming here. And I think that's something that we need to get some more data on and figure out. What we hear is just anecdotally, we hear, well, it's all these non-residents that are coming in here running around and not respecting, you know, our ground and all of that. I don't know how real that is, but I hear it. So, you know, that's something I think that, you know, in this Bear Summit scenario, we'd want to look at and see if there's some things we could do. I know Idaho's addressed it, so.
What does a non-resident bear tag cost versus a resident?
You would ask me that. I can look it up. I used to know all that when I worked on a front counter, but it's been a while since.
Versus 50, something 400 times.
I can find it out for you.
I think he's.
We had that discussion last year. I believe it was 400. Okay.
Yeah, it was about 480. Is that? That's what I was thinking. But sometimes I don't think.
Thank you, Clint. I'll let you sit down for just 1 second.
Maybe.
Other questions or comments by the rack?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Daniel?
I do want to say through this process, the division's been. Hands down, I'll tell you what, they're awesome guys to work with, and Clint's right. I mean, there was conflicts in the past, and that's where the recommendation came up to modify it to the San Juan and LaSalle last year, because it takes that 9-day period out of that rifle elk hunt where there's, you know, you're just the base way to put it is you're catering to those folks that have a lot of time invested into them hunts and points over the years. And so looking at that, that's where that suggestion came from. What these dates do, however, is with this trial, that's basically what they're asking, and what was agreed upon on the committee is to try it. We've tried this alternative method for 3 years, concluded our third year this year, and that's, again, it gets down to harvest. We haven't harvested too many. Restricting those hounds during those opening weekends of the archery hunt. I've archery hunted deer and elk most of my life. And then restricting them again during that rut period when they kick out the spike archery hunters. It's going to alleviate that pressure, the amount of people out there at the same time. And it's a fair statement to make that a lot of them hunters are going to harvest in that first time frame and disappear. We're talking a minimal amount of permits. I believe the recommendation is 6. What it does do away with is that archery only bait hunt, and the one thing I want to recommend about that is that hunt currently has 4 or 5 tags a year, and you're talking 30 applicants that put in for that, and that is it. So it's not a desirable hunt. It's a great opportunity for those that want to take advantage of it. It's not being utilized. By those that are serious, they're just using it for opportunity, which is what it's for. You know, the suggestion would be to take those permits and divide them up between the other 3 seasons so we can go ahead and harvest those bears that are recommended for that time frame. And that was, as a conservation group and sportsman, what the consensus was of that committee.
Thank you, Daniel. Other comments?
I've got a question, Mr. Chairman. So I'm looking at the fall black bear limited entry season, and so we're talking about the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek South unit, and it shows the season currently, the way you've got it, from October 1st to November 15th. Why is that one so different from all the others?
Yeah, the reason that they did that is, and Clint touched on this too, but we were getting a lot of complaints when it was earlier. So the other ones, they actually do overlap those archery seasons, both statewide and on the LaSalle's and Book Cliffs. On the LaSalle's and Book Cliffs last year, we had about 60 unsolicited complaints on the LaSalle's and another 30 on the San Juan. And so they've got concerns down there. What they've done is, we've recommended lowering those permits from 10 to 5 down there to try to put fewer people in the field. So that's how they're tackling it. But up here, what they did is they moved that hunt later. They just moved it out of that season to try to, to address those complaints. And I guess they haven't had any complaints since they made that change.
So this change would be pretty significant then for the book cliffs, because the starting date for that one now becomes, would be August 6th if we went with it. So it would start, a month, 2 months earlier. So, okay.
Thank you, Andrea. Other comments by the rec? Darren, how did the other four recs you've had their meetings, what did they do?
The first two voted to implement the Houndsman's recommendation on the book cliffs, but to leave the LaSalle's and San Juan as is. The Southern Region voted to implement the season structure on all three units as presented, basically adopted the Houndsman's recommendation. Last night in the Southeastern Region, they adopted it for the book cliffs as presented. They adopted it on the LaSalle's and San Juan, but they also, so there's some limits there. You've got that first week, the last week in their proposal. The Southeastern Racks also limited hounds during the any weapon deer season in October. But other than that, it'd be the same down there. So,
thank you. Discussion? Other comments? Joe?
In the last paragraph from this letter from the Houndsman, it states that at the Bear Committee meeting, they were all in favor of what their proposal is. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think,
and who was represented at that meeting? You had the slide up there.
Yeah, so we had Houndsman Association was there. Utah Bowman's Association had a representative there. Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I might have to go back to the slide. Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. Actually, the only people on the list that weren't there, Mule Deer Foundation didn't send anyone. And the non-hunting representative was not able to make any of the meetings either. So everybody else was there.
And they were in favor of this proposal?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
Other discussion? Okay, I'll entertain a motion on this action item.
Mr. Chairman, I'll make a motion.
Okay.
I motion that we accept the Utah Houndsman Association's proposal as presented, and the remainder of the division's proposal as presented.
Roy, that was Daniel Davis made that. Did you get that motion? Do we have a second on that?
Yeah, I'll second that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. That was Dan Abeda made that second. Discussion. Andrea?
Comment. It just looks to me like the Houndsman's recommendation, as far as the book cliffs, it does increase the hunting time, but also they've added in two periods for hound restrictions, and so they've added in 23 days, it looks like to me, in the season that people can't use hounds, which I'm guessing is designed for those the time that would be most likely to have the conflicts with hunting. So that seems like they put a lot of thought into it, and that, you know, it's reasonable.
Comment is I would prefer to stay one more year as recommended by the division and revisit it on schedule.
And so, Brett, just a question. So you think that there will be more conflicts if we...
In the book cliffs, absolutely.
And again, this has been 3 years now concluded. So it's happened over a period of time, and these recommendations come out after all this has transpired, and we've tried. The bear harvest isn't there. That archery only season didn't harvest a bear the first 2 years. The hound hunting, which your percent of success is a lot higher, hasn't been there. That earlier time frame is the optimal time to be able to take some of them animals out.
When you were referring to Darren, when you were referring to allowing it to continue one more year,
yeah,
what is the date out there that you were?
So the cycle would, this is the end of a 3-year cycle. Ideally, and this is probably more my fault than anything. You know, this is my first year through, and so I'm doing everything. I've done everything once now, and as I mentioned, we got to get way out ahead of this stuff. So we started realizing after we'd all met that there were other issues, and so our preference would be to tackle everything at once, and then make all the changes next year. That would put us a year off of the cycle. So.
I do want to point out, too, that this isn't just a houndsman advantage by no means. Those restriction dates allow for those other methods of hunting to minimize conflict. But you have spot and stock hunters that draw them permits. You have bait hunters that draw those permits. And those restriction dates don't apply to them. So the Buck Cliffs are remote. It's hard for people to get out here from the Wasatch Front. And allowing that additional time frame for them to have that opportunity is beneficial for all sportsmen alike.
Nope, no comments from the public, sorry. Other discussion? Well, we've had a motion and we've had a second. We'll call for a vote. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Got lots more raised hands down there.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Opposed? 1. You opposed?
I'm in.
Okay. So we had 7 in favor, 1 opposed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Maybe I didn't get yours, Tim. Was you opposed?
No.
Oh, in favor?
Yeah.
So it was 8-1. I'm sorry.
Or was it? I thought I saw two hands that were opposed.
Opposed. Raise your hands. Opposed. 1. Okay. Yes.
Right.
So it was 8-1.
Counted twice. He did it twice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Darren. Appreciate it. Now we're going to turn some time to Natalie Bourne, to talk about the Old Fort Pond. She's our regional aquatics biologist. Snooze, you lose. Oh. Well, actually, it's not an action item, but we'll take it. We want it.
Way too short for that. All right. So we're going to totally switch gears here and talk about fishing stuff for a while, but this is a pretty cool project we've been working on for some time now. Kind of an informational item. It's been in the works for quite a long time, so I'll just go through this slideshow with you real quick, and then you guys can provide any questions, comments at the end. What we're talking about is Old Fort Pond Community Fishery and Wildlife Management Area. And first off, why do we want a community fishing pond in our community? Well, there's some really cool things that they provide. So community fishing ponds are great locations for beginners to learn how to fish. They're stocked for higher catch rates, generally with smaller fish, but overall we can only stock brood stock when they kind of come available. So mostly for smaller fish, but generally we're looking at a quick fishing trip, somewhere around 1 to 2 hours or less. It's a place where a mom could take her kids and stop in as they're done with the grocery store before they go there. It's some place that that we don't really have yet in our region. It's a place where there's not a fee required. It's not like a state park, so you can go there without paying any fee to use it. Access for the elderly and or disabled anglers, and an opportunity for education in nature for groups such as school groups, church groups, and scout groups. And really, I think this is to provide a positive area for us to have in the future. So here's kind of a history of how we got to the point that we're at today. The idea of a community fishing pond started about 10 years ago, and it was originally proposed to occur at the Vernal Game Farm WMA property, which is located on 500 West and 3000 South. This pond location lacked an adequate water source, and it was a bit too sandy for us to pursue. It also ends up lying within what I'll talk about here in a second, these FAA exclusion zones. The second location that we tried to pursue one of these community fishing ponds was at the Naples City Park. We had some water rights issues there, and it, again, falls within this FAA exclusion zone. Recreation Center Park, this was over by the new rec center. We pursued that, and the county also pursued that a little bit, and again, it falls within this exclusion zone. So what is this exclusion zone that we're forced to deal with now? This is a 5-mile radius from the airport that we, as the Division of Wildlife, cannot stock fish in or build anything that technically brings waterfowl or birds that could interrupt a flight path. So it's kind of something that we didn't understand at the very beginning of this process, but it's made a difference in where this pond location is. And then lastly on this bullet point, so the current pond site is located at the mouth of Dry Fork Canyon. And this area really stems from a very gracious and thoughtful private landowner who had a vision of creating a fish pond for our community. And together we've worked towards making that their vision a reality. This shows the location of where the old Fork ponds will be and this new wildlife management area. So down on the right, you can see downtown Vernal. The upper square is where the new section of property is. Funny thing about the airport exclusion zone is it lies right on the very corner of our property now. So we're right outside of the 5-mile boundary with this property. Thank the Lord. Okay, so here's kind of a history of what we've done so far. So this all started in the summer of 2014. Myself and the private landowner started discussing this land donation for the creation of our community fishing pond. We thought, you know, is this real or is this just talk? So there was a lot of work that we had to do to figure out if we could even do this. And it started in the winter of 2015, and it's gone all the way through April of 2017 so far. So we've been through surveys, permitting trials and errors. We've been through wetland delineations, endangered plant surveys, 3 years of those, archaeological and cultural surveys, FAA negotiations, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, wetland mitigation permits. That was the most challenging thing to obtain. Went through a public comment period, and there's the link for that. The second part of this is the actual land acquisition. For a private citizen to donate land to the Division of Wildlife, number one, we needed the county's support. And we started talking with the county probably around 2015. Well, let's make that 2016 was the first time I went in there and talked with them. And we got their support for this project. And as soon as we knew that we had their support, then that was our next step to move forward with everything else on this that we've been through. So we've done outreach since then. At no point in time was this project ever any type of a secret by any means. It's always been something that we've been striving for. So we've done newspaper articles, radio interviews, attended county commissioner meetings, RDCC notices to all of our local governments. And then now this is the final phase of the RAC meeting. So what all happened with the Army Corps of Engineers? So we received 3 public comments, 3 letters with lots of comments, actually. We reviewed those and along with the Army Corps. So we had several in-person meetings with the Army Corps of Engineers to try to negotiate the number and location of ponds and the ratio for wetland mitigation. The final agreement was reached on how to address those concerns. We reached that agreement resulting in the new pond layout, which I'll show you guys here at the end here. It took a long, long time. Any negotiations with the Army Corps of Engineers takes forever. It took us 2.5 years to get through all the preliminary work and the negotiations and an investment from the DWR of about $48,000 to get that permit in hand. We were able to obtain that permit on April 28th of 2017. And really, I did not know if I was going to get that permit until the week before. So it's taken us a long time to get to this point. So what is our vision for this new pond and wildlife management area? Well, we want a safe, fun place for families, school groups, elderly, and all our community members to enjoy. We need to try to see if we could link this to a future trail system. It's kind of in the same path as the nature park is, so it might all work out. Wildlife, wetland, and historical interpretive site. So why is this thing called Old Fort Ponds? Well, it's going to sit at the location of the Carter Military Trailhead. That is right in the very corner of our property, and right below that is where Old Fort Thornburg used to sit. It was Vernal's very first fort. So there's some really cool interpretive things that we can do with this site, and I look forward to working with our State Historical Preservation Office and our Division of Wildlife archaeologists to make some really cool interpretive sites in this area. We have wildlife viewing here, conservation area that will remain protected for future generations. So just a really cool area within our community that these private landowners have allowed us to obtain. Where are we in the process now? So like I said before, the permit is secured. We've obtained funding for phase one in the amount of $233,000 to build this pond and protect the wildlife mitigation area. We've done Russian olive removal from the mitigation site. Wetland mitigation area and the disturbed area have all been set by the Army Corps, so we can't really do any adjustments to those. Final steps of the land acquisition, that took us almost as long as getting the permit. We finally signed the paperwork with the private citizens on November 17th of 2017. So all of that has been done now. All other aspects of the ponds, parking area, plantings are still sort of in the planning process. I make adjustments pretty much daily with the things that were dealt. So there's a lot of things that are still up in the air, but I've got a good idea of what we want to do. Exploratory excavation of the ponds will begin around January 8th. This phase will last 4 to 6 weeks. And then we'll come back in the spring to complete the landscaping, trails work, plantings, do all the security features and all that. I get asked all the time, when are we going to open it? You have to wait a little bit longer because I have to get it all the way done. So our anticipated opening is the spring of 2019, and I can't really verify a month quite yet. But as we get rolling on this and we see how the excavation goes, we'll just be able to see how everything works. I just don't want to open it too early. I want everything in place. I want it secure and all that jazz before we open it.
But you're growing the fish right now, right?
Right. Okay. So we did have a previous public meeting. A lot of the immediate citizens that live right around the area attended that. We had a packed house for that. We got a lot of comments, questions, concerns, ideas, things like that. So real quick, I'm going to run through what comments we already have received and what we've already tried to address. And they include all of these things. I'll touch on all of them. Traffic in the area. We know that that area is not used to this much traffic, and it will have a traffic. We will see a traffic increase in the area. We recognize that. We don't know. I mean, there's some things we can do, but there's also things that we can't do. It's just part of what we're building there. So what can the DWR do about it? We've talked with citizens about installing some solar radar speed signs on both sides of this new WMA. They are expensive, though. They're $3,000 a piece. But we're willing to try to get the funding to put those in. We'll work with the county on that. We've talked with our law enforcement and the sheriff's office about increasing patrols to that site. And honestly, the more I'm out there, the more sheriff's officers I see and the more of our law enforcement I see there already. So they're there, but they'll help us out when it actually goes online. Construction of the parking area, we want it small enough to adequately hold the daily use numbers that we're going to see, that we anticipate seeing, but large enough so cars are not parking on the roadway. If you guys go out there, you'll notice that the road is not that wide. I don't even think that it has lines on it. It's not even a too wide road. So we want to make sure that big enough to hold daily use, but not too big. So we have several considerations that we're thinking about right now. We're not going to construct the parking lot till next spring. But you can see kind of what some of our ideas are here. I do think it's important, though, to have somewhere where a school bus could turn around or at least drop kids off for whatever event they may be attending out there. I do think that's an important feature. What the DWR and county cannot do, we can't put any of those speed dips in the road, and we can't put any speed bumps because of snowplow issues. So that's what we can and can't do. Safety in and around the new WMA. So we've already constructed the exterior fence. It's a cattle exclusion fence number one, and then it's just separating the private property from our new WMA. So it's a four-rail wooden Z fence. It should do a good job of keeping things out and in. And then the front is a buck rail style fence. We're trying to make it rustic and kind of fit in with the old fort itself, so you'll notice that it kind of does look rustic, and it's because we wanted it that way. The west side fence line will have hawthorn plantings inside the actual fence to deter kids from climbing in and through and over the fence. This was a request of the immediate landowner straight across the street, and we have no problem doing extra plantings for that. I have one main entry gate on the northwest side of the property. We're going for solar-powered gates that will open and close automatically, and then they will be set depending upon daylight hours. One of the requests of the immediate public around the area was to have nighttime closures, which I agree with. There shouldn't really be anybody out there at night fishing community fishing ponds. There's no reason for it. So they will have a nighttime closure. And we'll have one other locked gate that's a service gate for DWR employees to fish stock from and then perform maintenance. Also going to try for some type of remote video surveillance system with camera monitoring, so you can keep an eye on things at all times. Technology these days is crazy. You can do a lot of things, so it's worth our time and effort, I think, to put this in so we can keep it free of vandalization, and if someone does do something, we can at least put a license plate to it. ADA access for kids, elderly and special needs friendly. The lower 10 acres of this, so the whole area itself is 14.4 acres. Then in the negotiations with the Army Corps, it was 4 acres of disturbance and 10 acres of wetland mitigation. It's a pretty good size ratio, but this is something we felt like we could handle as a management agency to keep tabs on the lower 10 acres and then manage the top four. And like I said before, we'll have an increase in officer presence for public safety. Water resources. How will we be getting the water? Utah Division of Wildlife has 76 currently owned shares of water that are at the Vernal Game Farm property. We'll be transferring 20 of those shares over to this pond site. If you're interested, those are the shares that we hold. Salt Lake City staff is working with irrigation companies to complete the share transfer applications. UDWR and engineers are currently working on a small low-hazard dam application, which will receive public notice. It's actually in my email right now, all finished, so we'll be turning that in pretty soon. Because of the layout of the land, it slopes to Ashley Creek, and we have a significant drop on one side. I wish it was the other way around, but I can't change the layout of the land, so we're going to be putting in a small dike towards the bottom to hold back water and keep the pond level. Fishing ponds will be designed to have flow through water, and they will flow from the ponds through into the wetland mitigation area, keeping that area wet, as we are instructed by the Army Corps to do. So the fishing ponds will be lined to retain water in the ground and allow for the entire area to remain wet. That's a big thing when it comes to future management of this wetland mitigation area. We need it to stay a wetland, and that's what we're trying to do. We will not know the exact amounts of water until the ponds can be constructed. This site is a challenging dig site, so the layout of the land and the geology will really determine the exact size of the ponds. And I'm hoping for two ponds right now, and we may end up with one. We just don't quite know yet. So no threatened and endangered fish species exist near this pond site. We'll stock fish that are biologically compatible with the area and appealing to the public. The exact species compositions on these are yet to be determined. We have a lot on our list, but we'll know more once the ponds are excavated and we can see how the water, the hydrology works, and look at the water quality there. So those are pretty much, those are the issues that were brought up during public meetings. Here's the current layout of the pond site. So everything in blue is the wetland mitigation area. Everything inside of those purple lines, including the ponds, parking area, restroom, that's all of our allowed disturbance area. And then everything outside of that remains private land. So that's our layout. We'll try for that. We'll see what happens here in January. Ideal timeline. So we started dewatering of this site on October 3rd, and it's been dewatering ever since. We have some dewatering wells with pumps on each one of those. They run 24/7. Digging in the ponds will start somewhere around January 8th and run until we're done. Construction of the parking area and post-pond excavation, spring in 2018, like I said before. Exterior fence construction to be completed by March. We'll install main entry posts and gates in the spring. Continue to construct wetland features, continue plantings, complete landscaping of the ponds in the WMA in the spring and summer of 2018. We have to do a phase two for funding of this to complete the final steps. So right now we've got in a water restoration initiative proposal along with Habitat Council funds to try to finish up. We'll need about $125,000 after we're all done with the first phase to finish everything else up. So we'll be putting in for that, and like I said before, we'll be shooting for an opening in spring of 2019. Another thing we're working on, too, is a management plan for this area. We've kind of started one internally. We've been working on that. We'll work with the county to get comment on that. I've already invited them and a few others, but everything is rolling as it should. And that's about it. If anybody wants to comment, has questions, I'm excited about the project, and I hope our community is as well.
Thank you, Natalie. We do have one comment. Scott Sowards, please step up the mic, state your name.
I'm Scott Sowards. Just wanted to thank Natalie for the work she's done, and as you can see, there's way more that project than I would have thought. You know, Kids Canal's been unusable now for, is it 3 or 4 years? The DW, you have
at least three.
Stocked it.
Maybe four.
And, you know, that was UNA Water Conservancy and Utah Department of Water Quality, and they all had issues, and so UNA Water Conservancy told them, you can't put fish in the canal anymore. Well, so here we are. There's over 50 of these in Utah. I'm just asking that the RAC can support it and get behind it, because they've been without a rural, I mean, we're out in rural Utah, but urban fisheries are actually in communities. You take the 5 mile deal and the valley's pretty much gone. But I just wanted to, I brought our scout troop tonight. We live in Mazer. They've several of these young men fish Condon's Pond, which is just across the street. I grew up fishing on Kids Canal. I know you did, and you probably did. And so the big losers in this were young people who haven't had a place to go. So we support it. We'd volunteer to do anything we could as a scout group to help with landscaping or any kind of thing that would be something we could do. But I'm just happy that we're getting something done, because it's the kids that have taken it in the shorts for over 3 years, and Natalie's worked hard for it, and I know she's reporting to you, but I wanted to let her know that we support her and this project, and ask the RAC, can't do a lot about it, but you can support it and speak highly of it, and I'm sure it's well underway, but it's time that we get, there aren't any of these in the Uinta Basin. This is the first pond of its type out here that I'm aware of, and there's over 50 in Utah, so I want to just tell Natalie thanks again, and appreciate hearing the RAC hearing us, and they'd all like to say something, but you know, I'm not going to let them. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. questions by the RAC for Natalie?
Yeah, I'd just like to echo what Scott said. Natalie, this is great for the community. Have you had any chance to talk with Jeff Russ, the forest archaeologist? Okay, good. Yeah, he's a great resource. He's got a lot of information about, I think it would be really helpful in terms of your interpretive adventure.
Other comments?
Natalie, followed this for a couple of years. Thank you for your work. I think this is going to be one of those projects that will be an icon in the community. We truly appreciate it. Natalie, I thank you for what you've done. And as a county commissioner, I would like to support you in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Any other comments, questions?
Oh, yeah, I just had one more question. So did you mention pets? I mean, people are going to want to take pets there. Is this going to be a state park where you're going to have your dog on a leash? Or?
So that's all part of our management plan itself.
Uh-huh.
There's distinct yes and no's to lots of questions there. Just things that we've been thinking about. And then a lot of the comments from the immediate vicinity neighbors. So yes, pets I've thought about. I'm kind of going back and forth on it. At minimum, they will have to be on a leash and people will need to clean up after them.
Sure.
But there's other things that we've thought about too, like boats. You know, are we going to allow people to launch watercraft there? No, we're not. They're just too small for that type of thing. And we've got Steinecker and Red Fleet and Starvation and every other thing around here. So there's a lot of details within that management plan that will address daily operations within that. But really what we want to do is we want to keep it maintained. We want to keep it nice for the public. And we want people to be able to go there and appreciate what it is. So we're going to try to take that management plan and address all those little details within it. And we'll probably put that out for some type of public comment when we get it all complete. It's going to take me a few more weeks to get it done. So we will have that, though.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? Nicely done. Thank you. I think it'll be great.
Thank you.
All right. We've got one more item of information, the Flaming Gorge Management Plan. Turn the time to Ryan. He's our regional aquatics biologist also.
Yeah, definitely some hard presentations to follow. Today I'll be presenting our Flaming Gorge Reservoir Management Plan. We actually started this reservoir management plan back in 2006, believe it or not. It's gone through several iterations. A lot of changes occur when things become unavailable or available, speaking more towards species of fish like rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, things of that nature. But also as administrations change, things change. I think I can speak for Trina, and we're really happy to see this coming to some type of conclusion. It's been a long process, a lot of iterations, and a lot of effort along the way. So thank you very much for listening to me today. I definitely drew the short straw presenting this, but there were several co-authors with this document. The primary author was actually Rob Keith from Wyoming Game and Fish out of the Green River office. But, yeah, Trina and I were involved with this along with several other people along the way. So for those of you that aren't familiar with Flaming Gorge Reservoir, it's just a really small pond up on the Utah-Wyoming border. It's only 42,000 acres large, but it's about 91 miles long at a full pool elevation of about 6040, so that's 6,040 feet. The reservoir is actually managed by the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. It normally fluctuates between 6,025 feet and 6,033 feet, so it doesn't fluctuate quite as dramatically as like a Lake Powell, but it does move about during the course of the summer, depending on hydrology in the river basin above. It's a national recreation area that's actually managed by the U.S. Forest Service. They only have a few in the nation, but it's one of those. And it also includes the Green River below Flaming Gorge Dam, down to the confluence of Red Creek. Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and Wyoming Game and Fish actually jointly manage this reservoir fishery. And we actually break the reservoir down into unique management regions, the inflow, the open hills, and the canyon, which are depicted up on that photograph right there. And that photograph actually does a great job showing these regions. These regions are broken down by not only the unique geography or geology in the surrounding area, but also unique water quality attributes, and then also fish distribution and growth within those regions. The top one, if you can see it up there in the upper left-hand corner, that's the inflow. It's properly named because it's where the two largest tributaries actually enter the reservoir, the Black's Fork River, which actually comes down from the north slope of the Uintas, and then also the Green River, which empties out of the Wind River mountain range up in Wyoming. From there, that line right there indicates the Skunk Cliffs. So from the Skunk Cliffs down to the start of the canyon, which is at the Boar's Tusk, that area is called the Open Hills. And that actually crosses the state line. So the state line is actually right underneath Open Hills, that label right there. But if you look at that surrounding terrain, that's rolling sagebrush hills, why it was actually named that. That part of the reservoir is large bays, moderate depths. It does have quite a bit of nutrient input, but a lot of wind-driven mixing. It's actually probably the highest densities of fish in the reservoir located within this area and really high growth rates for fish. And then you get down in the lower portion of the reservoir from the Boar's Tusk down to the dam. That's collectively called the canyon region, and you can see why there. Real steep cliffs, real steep gradient country on the shoreline, very little shoreline access actually. Deeper water, cooler water, not as much wind-driven mixing, and as a result of less nutrients, a lot slower growth in that part of the fishery. So Flaming Gorge fishery itself, pictured here is a large lake trout that we netted this past spring. It was about 32 pounds. Definitely a remarkable fishery if you haven't utilized it. In 2013, the fishery was actually valued $12 million to the state of Wyoming and $15 million to the state of Utah. And this is in a pretty rural region of both states. You know, you consider there's just not a lot going on. I mean, for Daggett County, Flaming Gorge and the Green River are the bulk of the economies. Management species in the reservoir are dominant sport fish species are kokanee salmon, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, lake trout, and smallmouth bass. Also identified in the Flaming Gorge Management Plan is burbot. But not that we're managing for them, but actually against them. They're an invasive species that were illegally introduced into the Green River drainage in the early 2000s, maybe late 1990s, but they were first found in Flaming Gorge in 2006. And then also we've identified ways that we will prevent aquatic invasive species like quagga mussels, zebra mussels. Both states have definitely taken a very strong role in reducing any type of introduction of those species into the reservoir. Management objectives, first and foremost, is work closely with Wyoming Game and Fish Department. It's important to have a strong team work or team effort when manage a reservoir of this size, this nature, interstate fishery. As you can see on the right-hand side, we got brown shirts, we got red shirts. People are holding fish, but they're not holding up any gloves. So we try to get along as much as possible. We actually collaborate on a lot of our work projects on the reservoir as much as possible, so it's been a really good working relationship. Much of the work that we accomplish on the reservoir is to monitor, maintain, and enhance the sport fishery. In the Flaming Gorge Management Plan, we've identified target levels for all our sport fish species, and this is determined by sampling efforts that we conduct on the reservoir each year. I just put up a few examples right here. We target greater than a 600,000 kokanee salmon that are two-year-old or less. Kokanee salmon in this fishery are not only a desired sport fish species, they're actually the most desired sport fish species, but they're also the primary forage for trophy lake trout in the reservoir. We've also identified catch rate components for rainbow trout, cutthroat trout from our gill net surveys. It used 0.35 fish per hour, so to make sense of that, if we set a net for 4 hours, or three nets for 4 hours, which is our standing operating procedure for all our stations around the reservoir, we would expect to see just over four fish in each of those nets. That would be a minimum threshold. So, and not each net, but all three nets combined. So that would be a minimum threshold. We typically see higher than that, but if we start seeing four fish in three nets in a four-hour set period, we're definitely getting concerned. So in that case, we would actually respond to that by changing stocking recommendations, changing regulations, maybe addressing predation issues, things of that nature. So that's what all these goals are establishing the plan so it can help drive management in the future. We also monitor health condition and forage characteristics for all sport fish species. Angler catch rates, so I put that there. We actually do angler surveys periodically, and so what we hope to find is when we do all this sampling, we want to make sure the fishery is there, but we want to also make sure the anglers have the capability to use it, right? So angler catch rates we set at 0.5 fish or 0.5 trout per hour. That's actually right in line with both states, so the recommendations from both states. And so if you go out as an angler, we hope that you would at least catch one fish in every 2 hours of fishing. Of course, that's just an average. We'd really like to see you doing better than that, not less than that. Maximize the harvest of burbot and maintain a catch rate of less than one fish per hour. Once again, they're an invasive species. We're trying to minimize any impacts from burbot on the remaining sport fish in the reservoir. So we're trying to keep those fish at really low levels in the reservoir, and we utilize different techniques to do that. Currently, we're working with fish derbies around the reservoir to maximize harvest or exploitation of that species. We're discussing some other opportunities or tools in the future, too. And then I also put in there, again, prevention of aquatic invasive species like quagga mussels and zebra mussels. Some of our stocking strategies and enhancements. Most people don't realize this, but it's actually three agencies that stock Flaming Gorge Reservoir: Wyoming Game and Fish, Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, specifically Jones Hole National Fish Hatchery. Collectively, we stock 640,000 8 to 10-inch rainbow trout a year in the reservoir, about 200,000 8-inch cutthroat trout per year, and then also 1.65 million 3-inch or fingerling kokanee per year. All this is conducted by three agencies, so it takes a lot of effort and planning to get that done. These fish are typically stocked in May or June when the growth potential is highest. Brown trout and catfish were historically stocked by Wyoming Game and Fish, and they may be in the near future, but they haven't been able to do that for the past few years. Wyoming Game and Fish and Utah Division of Wildlife Resources also work collaboratively in Sheep Creek, a tributary just south of Manila, Utah, where we trap wild kokanee salmon, do streamside spawning and egg collections, raise those in hatcheries, and that's what we stock back into the reservoir the following spring. Some of those eggs are also utilized in other waters in the state of Utah, like Starvation, Strawberry, Fish Lake, when egg needs are met for Flaming Gorge. Just briefly, some of the management activities that we utilize. We evaluate the fishery in spring and fall using gill and trammel nets. This is all in conjunction with Wyoming Game and Fish, so when they're on the water, we're on the water. We monitor water quality and zooplankton levels on the reservoir during the summer to make sure that we're not overstocking, overshooting our target levels for zooplankton. We monitor kokanee salmon using hydroacoustics. It's an elaborate form of a sonar survey, which allows us to count fish, also determine fish size, depth in the water column, and even direction. We actually do these surveys throughout the length of the reservoir, and then we go back and truth those surveys with trawls the following night. Smallmouth bass monitoring, we utilize boat electrofishing at 44 transects throughout the length of the reservoir, and we also conduct smallmouth bass transplants Right now in the current situation, we have a high densities of smallmouth bass in the canyon or Utah portion of the reservoir and low densities of smallmouth bass in the upper end of the reservoir where burbot predation is such a problem. So we're actually moving smallmouth bass from the lower end up to the upper end to try to augment that population. Monitor and suppress invasive burbot once again. I already briefly touched on this. Conduct angler surveys to evaluate catch and harvest rates, but we also determine opinions and preferences towards the fishery. So all this effort, you know, you try to provide this fishery, we want to make sure that everybody's enjoying it to the utmost. And we learn a lot through those types of surveys, you know, what things that we can do different in the future. Based on our response from all these different surveys, we adjust regulations if and when necessary. And then it always seems like the more we learn, the less we know, or is it the more we know, the less we learn? I don't know. But continued research, we're always coming up with different research ideas to identify or answer questions to problems that we're seeing in the fishery. So, and with that, does anybody have any questions for me?
Go ahead, Daniel.
I got one question. I seen an email come out today, a press release from Mark. Encourage anglers to keep more of the smaller lake trout. Can you elaborate on that?
So what we're currently seeing in the reservoir is our small lake trout population is, for lack of a better word, exploding. Over the last few years, we've seen a 90% increase in the small lake trout population. And over that time period, or even going back into the 90s, we've also seen slower growth rates in lake trout. So now with this, as growth rates have been slow and now we're seeing this increase in small lake trout, it's going to be even more of a problem. So the last thing we want to get into is a situation where we're impacting that trophy component, because one, we have too many mouths to feed at the bottom end and not enough to go around at the top end. There's actually a prominent fishing guide here tonight, and we actually had this discussion outside a little while ago. If we have too many fish in the bottom end, you know, we're going to have less fish making it through that slot barrier too, or, you know, the 28-inch slot that he was discussing earlier. So, yeah, we're people keep lake trout. So we currently have a regulation that allows anglers to keep 8 fish, but only 1 fish over 28 inches to protect that trophy component, and very few anglers even keep the 8 fish limit. So I wouldn't expect we'll be making a increase in our regulation in the near future, but you're probably going to see more outreach like you saw today to try to get anglers just to keep more. I mean, they can be extremely difficult to catch, but anglers are catching and releasing them anyway. So what we want to do is try to, well, they got them in hand, we want to get them to keep them. They're extremely good to eat, contrary to popular belief, and they're extremely high in omega-3 fatty acids, which of course is very beneficial and nutritious. So yeah, we hope we can make a difference and kind of turn the tide on that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Other questions or comments for Ryan?
We've actually been utilizing a Bear River strain that comes out of Wyoming. They've been providing those eggs to Jones Hole National Fish Hatchery, and they've been performing really well. This past year, they actually went 50-50, so Bear River and Colorado River cutthroats. We haven't seen any returns up to this point for Colorado's. The Bear Rivers have been doing really well. We're hearing a lot of positive angler reports from Bear Rivers. Yeah, we're going to wait and see what happens with the Colorados. Based on what we're seeing so far, though, we've had discussions with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we'd like to see them continue Bear Rivers into the future. Ironically enough, I was out fishing last week, and I caught 3 cutthroats, 3 Bear River cutthroats, and they don't even stock those cutthroats on the Utah portion of the reservoir. They stock them in Wyoming. That's a Wyoming quota, and they were all the way down by the dam. So, and they were extremely healthy, impressive fish.
So they are showing up in the grill.
They are showing up in the grill. Yep. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Go ahead, Dan.
Ryan, are there currently any restrictions on filleting fish up on the reservoir?
You just cannot be in the act of fishing.
Okay. Are you guys seeing any issues with filleting fish there?
Not to my knowledge. Ryan's here, he might be able to speak to that a little bit more. But yeah, as long as you're not in the act of fishing, if you're completed fishing, you may clean your fish, you can clean them on the water.
Okay.
You're supposed to dispose of them in a location that obviously isn't going to be a public nuisance, correct? But as far as I know, there is no issues.
Okay.
That I've heard with that.
All right.
Other questions, comments? Anybody in public? RAC?
One more quick question on the bourbon.
Yes, Scott.
Well, we know they're
not sours.
Thanks, Randy. We know the bourbon are out of control, and we're doing what we can to get rid of them. But so it's probably too early to tell. But I know you're saying you've done what you can, and we've got the contests and everything. But seems like the lake trout are surviving, and so they must still be spawning and that with even with the bourbon. But so I guess you're just working with what you can to get rid of the burbot, and public anglers are probably one of your best bets there.
Right? Definitely one of the best and probably the cheapest. There are other options. As you know, we've done everything we can with regulations. They're unlimited. They're must-kill species. We've actually made it now in both states where you can legally waste them. You don't have to utilize those species. And that was a very difficult process for the state of Wyoming, because in Wyoming, burbot are actually native, and they're protected on the east side of the Continental Divide, where in the Green River drainage, they're not. So for them to go to unlimited must-kill and allow waste, that was pretty substantial. Having said that, you know, we work with these derbies, promote harvest as much as possible. We do a lot of outreach, promote harvest as much as possible. There's obviously some other tools that we could utilize. One thing that would jump to everyone's mind, I'm sure, considering Utah Lake, would be commercial harvest. That's a possibility, but of course there's an expense with that. One thing that we've recently considered too, that is a harvest incentive program. That's a great word for it. Where we would actually pay anglers to harvest burbot. So, Scott, if you went out and you caught 20 burbot, you could take those to a check station where you would get a check for $20, you know, a dollar per tail or something of that nature. So, Lance would actually get a pretty good paycheck for that, being he harvests about 2,000 a year. But, those are some things that we're considering. We obviously want to do what we can as much as we can. The burbot population isn't declining. It isn't really increasing. It's kind of flatline. It has been pretty much since 2006. It's had some fluctuations. We see downs and we get excited. We see ups, we get depressed. But anything that we could do to just put more pressure on that population would be advantageous. It'd be great if another predator would utilize them. It's unfortunate that lake trout don't. Yep, that's the cards we've been dealt. So we're considering those two other options.
What's the regulation on that waste? I guess is that something where you can just go ahead and dispatch that fish and put it back in the water? Or is that if you got to take it with you?
It's just got to be killed. You can dispatch them. As far as I know, you can dispatch them and put them in the water. We had issues when they first started doing that 2 years ago where people were dispatching them and leaving them on the ice. Can't do that. That's a problem, because then somebody else comes out and they see a bunch of dead burbot laying on the ice. It's a public nuisance at that point. I think it becomes littering. So, yeah, you just got to discard them in a place where they're not going to be observed by the public, whether that's through the hole in the ice or up in the sagebrush, or probably more appropriately in a landfill or in your dumpster when you get home, so you don't get in a questionable area. Would you agree, Brian?
I agree.
Okay.
Other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you, Ryan.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. And if anybody wants a copy of the presentation or a copy of the management plan, I brought some of those along if you want some light reading.
Well, we appreciate everybody being here tonight. I'll entertain a motion to close.
I motion that we go ahead and adjourn this meeting.
Made by David Gordon. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
All right, Daniel Davis made second. All in favor. It's unanimous.